Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of December. The horror of what took place on Friday was partially so horrible because kindergarten children were killed. So many people have talked about children, and we've all thought about our roles as parents or grandparents or uncles or aunts, and looked at the role that adults play in trying to guide the children through their lives. As the president said last night, there's nothing we wouldn't do to shield our children from harm, that we need to give them what they need to be self-reliant, to be capable human beings. We will have to change, he said. We cannot tolerate this kind of horror anymore. There's been way too much of it. And we need to care enough to keep our children safe from harm. And the vast majority of us do just that. What do our children need from us this week? What do they need from politicians? What do they need from teachers this week? What do we need in order to move into a time of change? What is that change that we need? Connie Kilmark is joining us this hour. Connie is a wise and sensitive soul. She is founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark and Associates. And we wanted to give you a chance to talk about how you have taken all of this in your hearts with this kind of nonstop coverage of an event that really makes us sick to our stomach. What do you do about this? How in the world can you explain this kind of horror in the world? What kind of fears do you have about your children going to school today? How should schools deal with this? Why do any of us have to deal with this kind of event? Connie is joining us this hour to take those kinds of calls, and here is how you can reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can always send us a tweet, and that's @KDunnShow. Hello, Connie. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
We were talking over the weekend how we, and maybe we need to look at old episodes of Mr. Rogers. We need Fred Rogers today, don't we?
You know what Fred was so brilliant at was that he didn't bring... I wish I could have people write these words down. He brought presence. P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, not presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S.
Mm-hmm.
He was such an abiding presence that there were days when my kids were too old for Fred Rogers that I would have him on.
Yes.
Just because I right. needed Mr. Rogers.
I know. We need Mr. Rogers. And I must say, I thought that the president last night, I said this hour one, was quite extraordinary.
Yes.
He wasn't exactly Mr. Rogers. He was the president who wants to take some kind of action, but he really put together some extraordinary words last night.
He made me feel like we may be able to have some grown-ups in the playground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need the sense that we have the spine and the capacity to put sane limits and to do the things that we can do to help unmarinate our collective imagination from guns. It seems as if you look at our Westerns, if you look at our history, it's as if we see guns in all of our collective mythology as if they were the answer or the source of security. And if you add to that money, which is my beat in life, you know, we think that our sources of security are guns and money, or money and guns, depending on the order you might put them in. Oddly, for a financial person, I'm often in the position of helping rather wealthy people put less expectations on their personal fortune and feel less fearful about it. Because, in fact, what did those folks last night need most of all? They needed each other.
Yes, they did.
They needed each other, and that's true for all of us.
What are the sources of security, you used that phrase, that we need to give our children now? What are we missing? What are they missing?
Well, it seems to me that they're missing the kind of unhurried time and the cyclical traditions that come round and round. If I could say for the rest of this week what families could do, make traditional recipes, include the kids, don't worry about the mess, let them put flour on the floor, just be there and be that kind of presence with them that gives that beginning, because they will face, and we all face, complete unknowns in our future lives. And all we can do is stock up on the wisdom of our elders and the sane and calming presence of the things that we always do. You know, we always make our bed. This is the way we wash clothes. This is the way that we put the dishes away. This is the way that we make this particular dish. And I'll write it down for you so when you go to college, you have a piece of home that goes with you.
Yes.
That's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about, as I write Christmas cards, I'm thinking about friendships. I'm thinking about, you know, all of that. I'm not thinking about stuff.
Mm-hmm. You're thinking about, as we talked about earlier, the things that matter in life. And
that's right.
Hopefully we would think about those just about every day of our lives.
Well, you know, we're very much about stuff. We're very much about things. And I've been thinking that the things that matter are not things. The things that matter are people. And making more time and perhaps less stuff. You know, our collective country is awash in stuff that we open and then probably don't really need. We have storage lockers. We have exported our basements into, you know, other places where we have extra basements in these storage lockers. I don't know. I'm just thinking that I almost see the silver lining in our very extended recession. Because in the face of unemployment and in the face of smaller money, people are finding ways to have an economy made out of thoughtfulness and people. They're finding ways to be creative and to be thoughtful of each other that just doesn't involve credit cards and shopping malls. Now, that may be subversive because we're supposed to go shopping in order to, quote-unquote, lift the economy. But honestly, it takes so much more of your soul to think about the person than it does if you just go to the store and spend $100.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that the pleasure of that in the thinking about the person, the inhabiting imaginatively of your friend or your family member, that's part of the gift that comes to the giver. It's not just for the giftee. It's for the person who's giving the gift. And that's one of the small tools that we use to knit community together. Gift giving is universal. There's not been a culture found that doesn't do some sort of gift giving.
I would imagine that given the events that have taken place in this country and our national focus on horror right before Christmas will make all of us think about Christmas and Hanukkah and this whole season in a different way, and I'm not sure how, Connie, but somehow a different way.
I think so. I think that there's a terrible and very proximate shadow that's been cast by this. If we could gather all the children, especially the poor children who die from gun violence one by one in many of our poor inner-city neighborhoods, if that all happened at the same time, perhaps we would have some of the same stunning shock and amazement and terror and but there are so many more than these. The drama of these is that they happened all at once and so senselessly and so young and so purposefully. You know, this was so on purpose. Of course, the purpose we do not know yet. We will never probably know the full sense of that. But this shadow is cast across a season where, if we're from the Jewish tradition, we light the lights of Hanukkah. And if we're from the Christian tradition, we think of the Christmas miracle and the light shining, the Bethlehem star. We need light this season, and we need light that's shared with each other. And the stuff is going to pale, I think. The stuff under the tree is going to pale besides the fact that we're going to be able to hug each other.
Yeah, exactly. I think that we're similar in that we have a very hard time taking in images of horror. I can't really see horror films. I don't go to any of those. They just stay in my mind and they just make me feel terrible and nightmares and all of that. How can young people, let's take on this issue of keeping our children as safe as we can keep them and exposure to all of this and conversations about all of this at this time. Are we best to do as you and I do and kind of walk away from it, or is that unrealistic?
I'll give you an example. I have a daughter who's a vulnerable person. She's 28 and she happens to be on the autism spectrum. She's vulnerable by definition. Something like 85% of young women who are developmentally disabled in some way will be sexually abused before they're gone. So it's an extraordinarily vulnerable population. And she experiences this kind of violence and 9/11 in a way that's extremely visual. We've talked, and she happens to be living with me for a few days while a bathroom remodeling project is happening at her home. And I'm actually very grateful that I'm here, that she's here, and I can monitor her experience of this. And I think that in this case, I'm kind of surprised that she's saying, I really feel sorry for those families, but she's not feeling it to be right here, close at hand.
Right.
And I think the wise counselors among us know that you don't want to open a subject more widely than the child is ready for. You want to answer questions. You want to be prepared. You may want to say, how are you doing with this? You know, is there something you want to talk about? But you don't want to go over it and over it, because in a strange way, if we overwork it, we're giving them the sense that we must feel that this is so scary that we need to be working on it extra hard.
Mm-hmm.
So to some degree, you know, I was thinking about all the people that were right there on the scene, each family member, each witness, each first responder, all those ER nurses and doctors. I think of each of them as being on a stretcher themselves. They're the trauma victims, and that stretcher of trauma is so heavy that it's going to take 10 or 15 people many hours to lift that stretcher and carry it with each of them. For each other, what we can do most is to help bear what is essentially the unbearable, just by being patient and listening and being there for each other. Yesterday in church, I think during the sermon, I saw so many of the moms just with tears running down their faces, just, you know, but we were together. That sense of being in a group, sharing the sorrow somehow. And in that way, if we can absorb it, then we can be a calm presence for our kids.
Connie Kilmark is our guest this hour. When we scheduled Connie last week, we wanted to talk about gift giving, because she lives in, can talk about both of these important worlds, the world of finance and also the world of human interaction. She's founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark and Associates, and we thought it would be a good time as we think about gift giving and some people being extravagant and some people not having money and how you deal with finances during this time. So she was scheduled to talk about that. And then this massacre took place in Newton, and we knew that we could not ignore that issue on this show on this day. And so we asked Connie to be able to talk about both. I would imagine that most of you still have on your minds the emotional response to what has taken place with all of the burials that will take place this week of 20 kindergarten children and their teachers. It will emotionally be a very difficult week for the nation. But it's also the week before Christmas, so take on all of those issues. You know, take on how we change, how we make our children feel secure, how we mark this holiday season, all of that The stuff that matters. That's what we're talking about this hour with Connie. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And you are always welcome to leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Connie Kilmark, our guest, and we go to your phone calls. Laura in Appleton is our first caller. Connie, hi, Laura.
Hi. You know, Kathleen, I'm thinking back to April of 1999 when you were still doing the afternoon show. And the day that the Columbine tragedy happened, you talked about it. And in fact, it was such kind of an urgent need that you expanded into your second hour on that. And I can't help but think back to that and mourn that all these years later, we are still talking about these events. You know, it just breaks my heart. And I think back to where I was at that time. I was in my early 30s. I was still single. I was a teacher at the time, though no longer at the K-12 level. And when Columbine happened, I distinctly recall thinking, I'm so glad I'm no longer in K-12 education. This is happening too frequently, because it was after Jonesboro and after Paducah, and I think maybe after the incident in Oregon, although I don't remember. And then, you know, it kept happening, and the tragedy at Virginia Tech, we thought it couldn't get any worse than that, and then this happens. And at that time, I recall thinking, you know, it's a good thing I don't have kids, because I couldn't bear for something like this to happen to them. Mm. And I started to think, how do you parent a child in a world like this? How do you raise them only to say goodbye to them in such a tragic way? Now, I eventually did have my own child. She's very young, but I can't help but worry about these things, you know? Every day when I send her to daycare, I make sure I give her a big hug and kiss and tell her I love her. And I'm going to do that as long as she allows me. And even when she doesn't want me to hug her anymore, I'll still tell her I love her. But, you know, this was a very real fear of mine. It wasn't just a passing thought. And it sounds irrational, I'm sure, to say, well, I can't have children because of these tragedies. But it really impacted my thinking as, you know, someone who is into her 30s already, about how wise is it really to have a child in this world. And I'm immensely glad that I did. You know, I'm immensely grateful I did. She brings me much joy. But seriously, it gives a parent pause when these things happen.
It sure does.
I'm so glad to hear this call, because I was thinking about the tough time that our teachers have had in, you know, in the public mind, being told that they have it too easy, that they have too many perks, summers off, and pensions. I have some friends that are teachers, and I can't think of a person in whom we put more ultimate trust than a teacher to whom we entrust our child for more waking hours a day than we may see that child ourselves. So I first want to thank our caller for just the fact that she spent some time doing that incredibly important work. And secondly, to say, you know, this is the essence of life. It doesn't get better when the children are older. You know, we worry and we think imaginatively about how we can make our children safe all the way through our lives. I have young adults, and they have a big world. And I want them to have the freedom of a big world. I want them to have the opportunities of a big world. But I don't know that that's consistent with a perfectly safe world. And as a result, we are stuck with the fact that we cannot make our loved ones perfectly safe. It is not possible.
Right. The president addressed some of that yesterday. I mean, and we know that as parents. And you know that your children will... You have to let them go.
Yeah.
And that is just the darn hardest thing to do. It's just hard, because you do want to shield them and protect them and make sure no harm ever comes to them in any way whatsoever, that nobody will say anything bad to them, that
right.
They will have these wonderfully rich, complete, lovely lives, and life just doesn't work that way.
Well, and, you know, frankly, the whole notion that we can ensure the future. We can't do it for ourselves. Our parents couldn't do it for us.
Exactly.
We're not going to be able to. We have to somehow bear the fact that we don't know what's mm-hmm. going to happen. The suspense of the future will be with us our whole lives. And that's just a fact.
Mm-hmm. It is.
That doesn't mean that we can't do something about the epidemiology of gun violence, though. I mean, we are awash in a public health crisis, as far as I'm concerned. This is not something we can do nothing about. This is something we have to marshal ourselves to do something about.
Mm-hmm. And do our children expect that?
Lord, if I can't imagine how they can articulate it, but surely if they look to us and we have nothing to say except to say it's the freedom of the Second Amendment for anyone to have anything that they want. Honestly, that's not much of an answer, Kathleen.
Sinette in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Well, you know, I think there is a great deal that each of us can do starting right this minute. And we can't expect politicians to solve anything, everything, or the police. They can do what they can do. But I have noticed as a parent and a grandparent and a teacher that there has developed a new culture of mean, a culture that it took a long time, but it's getting worse. And that is where the goal is to actually hurt other people, whether hurt their feelings, hurt their reputations, hurt anything possible.
And what, how are you
seeing into the physical?
How are you seeing this?
And
how are you seeing this?
In order to beat that culture of mean, I think we can do it. Now, like your guest was talking about, doing all these wonderful things as a family, which is just great, and I always did that too. Well, I would say include lonely children. Try to find out who would benefit by being included, somebody that doesn't have that at home, and include anybody you can, as much as you can, and encourage people to be children. You really actively encourage children to bring out the best in each other.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with Sinette, Connie, that we have a culture of mean?
I do. I agree with it, and in my notes in preparation for today's show, I'm just so grateful to these calls because they help me to remember what I want to say, and when someone else says it, it's only better. I was thinking about how valuable the word inclusion is across all forms of community. And the thing is, we can include the easy to include pretty easily. And I think our caller is highlighting a way of making an us out of something negative. There is a way that girls bond over being mean to whoever they isolate and are mean to. Boys can do it in a different way. They're usually more physical. There's a way that we know we need an us, but if the only way or one of the main ways that our kids are getting that us is by excluding somebody, then that child is the one that's terribly at risk, but it's also terribly risky for those kids that are doing either the excluding or the bullying. So I like what this caller is helping us to see, which is that we have to include even the hard to include. We have to find a way to draw a circle around the isolated, lonely ones. Include them in a birthday party. They may never get another birthday party invitation. Include and make that invitation be for everybody. Create a culture in your own family that says everybody counts. Everybody gets a Valentine if anyone gets a Valentine. You know, that kind of. There was a second grade teacher. I think you had her on your show once, and I've never forgotten her words. She had a rule in her classroom that said, "You can't say you can't play." And she created an entire culture in that room, working out with those little children's minds what that means. You can't say you can't play. And sometimes those kids came up to her when they were seventh graders, high school students, and said, I still think about that year when we worked out the rules, when we worked on the idea of you can't say you can't play. Imagine with tiny children how long-lasting the effect of that notion is.
You asked the question, and I've thought about this since we talked, who put the goodness in you? And that teacher did that, and that's a good thing to reflect on.
Yeah.
How do you do that with other human beings, and who did that for you in your life? Because it's so important.
I like the way that you put it. Perhaps I said it, but I love the way it sounds coming out of your mouth. Who put the goodness in you? Yeah.
Because we draw on that as a much better bank account than money. I mean, so much more valuable. Mm-hmm. It gives us the resilience to somehow, in these moments, bear the unbearable, but also to share the joy, you know, to give each other the light of our happiness or each other's happiness.
Right. Thanks, Annette, very much for the call. Let's go to Rosalie in West Salem. Hi, Rosalie.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I work in child care. I cook, and I'm listening to the children out in the background. And one of the things that I see throughout the time is that the family unit is basically how the child perceives the world. When there's trouble at home, there's trouble here. You have to calm down the kids and hope that those that have a stable family life can help in that. And the teachers work hard at making all of the children feel as if they're equal. I think that part of the breakdown of the family becomes two parents working to give their children as much as they can. Sometimes the companies tell us that we have to give too much. We don't know when to stop because the kids keep seeing what I should have. And we feel, if it makes them happy, I have a job. I can't make them happy in other ways. And we tend to overdo what they have. And we should just basically be happy with each other's company rather than a possession.
I love what you're saying. And here's a piece of what it takes. It takes being able to have the courage to know that our presence is more important than the gifts for our kids. We have to bear that they're not going to die from some other kid having a little bit more or a little bit better than they. We have to know what our priorities are as a family and have conviction about that so that we are not made to feel, we don't feel guilty about not giving our kids more or better. We give them what they need, and what they need more than anything is us. I also agree with you that teachers know the second that the child walks into the house, whether or not, into the classroom, whether or not there was a good morning or a bad morning. So parents, just forget about your confidentiality because teachers see right through your family. They always do, and they're rooting for us, and we ought to be rooting for them. So I used to just call the teacher and say, it was a rough morning, a little storm is going to walk into your room, because they were going to see it anyway.
Thank you, Rosalie. I'm glad you were listening this morning. Let's go to Harry in Madison next. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Harry.
Hi. I just want to ask a question. Could something be wrong with the culture?
Would you say more about that, Harry?
Oh, Harry's going to leave that up to you, Connie.
Well, the two of us together can say some. There are so many remarkably idealistic things that are true about the United States. It's a country that has such an amazing amount of enterprise and inventiveness and ingenuity. At the same time, we have more per capita prison population than any other country on the planet. We have more depression per capita than any other country on the planet. That is to say, we have more medication being dispensed for depression. I think when we try to tell ourselves that we live in paradise, we're forgetting how many people don't have health care.
Right.
We're forgetting all of these issues. We are a country with a particular history and a particular kind of mythology and imagination, and it's not all perfect.
No, it sure isn't. And those who have and those who have not, that keeps getting wider and wider. The gap between those populations get wider. And there is something about this horrendous violence that seems to be consuming us. I mean, I can't take it anymore. You can't take it anymore.
And those who say the teacher should be armed, can you imagine? I just find the answer to guns being more guns just doesn't make any sense to me. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
It feels like there's a threat everywhere, and I think we're marinated in anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it breaks out. You know, the anxiety gets
right.
So high that we then get a big burst, and it's just...
Yeah, I think you're right. We are anxious. I taught for a while high school. I can't imagine bringing a gun to the classroom.
Oh.
If that's a part of the job description, no thank you.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Jay in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, Jay.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I think that, you know, the cuts in mental illness, you know, funding, and then also taking Christ and religion out of everything in this country is really caused this issue and this wave of problems that we've been having. I mean, every single one of these issues, the guns were purchased legally, you know, and it's not the gun that killed anybody. It's the mental ill person that did it. And they're not really talking about this. It seems like the politicians will use it as a platform to forward their own agenda any way they can. And it's so sickening to hear that more than anything else.
I'm very supportive of your observation that our mental health services are insufficient. We are only a little way into making it okay to seek counseling, and there are still populations where it is completely not okay to seek whatever help is available, and there's not enough. I'm thinking of all our returning warriors who themselves have been trained in firearms of a military sort and have sometimes seen unbearable things and sometimes have done what is, you know, essentially when you're in battle, you're doing what is against all that you've been taught. You shall not kill.
Yes.
And, you know, it's part of the job in war. So that's a trauma to the person, and it's a specialized skill to work with returning veterans, and they need us. The suicide rate is terrible, and those are the folks who, you know, who are stranded, and we need to make sure that the services are there. These are not luxuries; these are necessities.
Thanks for the call, Dee Dee in Round Lake. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and Connie.
Good morning, Dee Dee.
You guys are like so close to what I think is such a big part of the problem. The mental health, I think right now, so many times doctors and parents are going to these antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs. And rather than resolving them the way they used to, by all the things that Connie has been talking about, nurturing our children, making them feel included and stuff. Also, early in the program, we talked about the culture having guns and money. Now it's guns, money, and the drugs. The drugs make people feel better. And if you look back, I believe every single one of these mass shootings, the perpetrators have either been on these antipsychotic drugs or have just gone off them. And I don't think handling the guns is going to handle anything. You have to address the thing that's making these people feel like it's okay. Something snaps in their mind.
Connie.
You know, our mental health services are governed by our health and hospital insurances, you know, our various health insurance programs, because that's just how we've set our system up. And my colleagues who are therapists talk about how limited the services are that they can provide. What people need more than anything else is to be heard. They need to feel that they can unfold themselves in a safe presence with the time for the complexity that they bring to be fully heard. I think one of the things, by being such an independent person as I am in my practice, because I'm not covered by health insurance, one of the things that I consider to be one of the strongest things I bring to my work is that people get long sessions with me. That is to say, they will have 2 to 2.5 hours to help me to see the world through their eyes. It is amazing how often a person can find a way within their own resources to solve problems and to bring peace back to a family in conflict if there's a sufficient amount of safe and intense listening that can be brought.
It's as if they were hearing themselves solve their own problems. They didn't know what they knew until they could express it in the presence of somebody who's giving undivided attention. And so I think the caller is right that a quick answer in the interest of the economics of getting, you know, more productivity or faster fixes isn't the answer. We need to give time to each other.
When you think about, we asked this last hour, Connie, when you think about, we're talking about so many huge issues this hour, who needs to be at the table to help us answer the question, what do we need to do in order to change, to prevent tragedy, to prevent mass shootings, to prevent, you know, mental illness or control mental illness? Who needs to sit at that table? Who would you put at that table? This encompasses so much.
You know, the teachers know some things about our kids that we don't know.
You're right.
Parents know some things about the kids that the teachers don't know. Mm-hmm. The churches know some things, and the synagogues and the Sunday school and Hebrew school teachers know some things, and the imams and the teachers in the Muslim community, they know some things. The police officer on the beat in the neighborhoods, I can't tell you how supportive I am of neighborhood policing, where, you know, when you're a detective, you're investigating these kind of crime scenes, but when you're a neighborhood police officer, you go to the festivals. You talk to the folks, you get to know the neighbors. You sometimes say happy birthday to somebody. You're not only seeing the horror, but you're also experiencing the community. Those folks know something. They know some things about our kids. The kids themselves need to be, to some degree, at the table, because the adolescents, especially our adolescent boys, they know some things about each other, and they don't feel, I'm not so sure that they feel that they can trust us with what they know. They experience things in schools that I know they're protecting us from, especially those of us that are middle-class parents that are innocent of what they're actually facing.
You're right. You
and then when
so
we hear
right
about
that.
It years later, we think, mm-hmm. Oh my Lord, how did my child bear that by himself?
Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, though, the same thing was true of us, perhaps
yes.
In different ways, but it was true of us. Yeah.
Yes.
More phone calls in a moment. Connie Kilmark is our guest this hour. Connie is the founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark and Associates, and we're welcoming your phone calls on, well, you know what we're talking about. What matters? 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow on our program at 9 o'clock, we'll be speaking with Colin Goddard, who I happen to see on television over the weekend and thought he was an extraordinary young man. He's a survivor of the Virginia Tech massacre that left 32 people dead, and he survived 4 gunshot wounds that day. I believe at least 2 of the bullets are still in his body. He's gone on to become the assistant director of victims and youth advocacy and federal legislation for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Also tomorrow, Richard Florida on the geography of gun violence in this country. Connie Kilmark is our guest this hour. We go to Pat in Lafarge next. Hi, Pat.
Hi. You guys are talking about including stuff. And I know as a single parent, I always try to include my kids' friends. Mm-hmm. A lot of their friends don't have parents that do stuff with them. But also the thing that really irritated me was the different news people who were saying that autism is a mental illness and that autistic people are violent.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and
good grief.
That's just not so true. And I guess the last thing is we try and make these environments, we call them gun-free zones, and we believe by putting up signs saying it's gun-free that something's not going to happen to there at all. And it actually makes it a place where somebody would go. I mean, are you going to want to go someplace where, you know, into a police station to shoot people, or would you go to a school where nobody's going to be armed at all? You know, it's part of the society and how they try to, I guess, make us feel better about stuff when it really doesn't help.
I think we really do need a conversation about mental illness, because I agree with him. There has been, we've heard that he is on the autism spectrum somewhere. Obviously, you know this better than anybody, with your daughter, Connie, that this does not indicate somebody's going to be a violent person.
Well, and it's also critically important that we understand that autism is a neurological difference. It's not a mental illness. It's a neurological difference that's born, and it's a central nervous system difference. There are some folks on the autism spectrum, many of them technically quite bright, who would say that it comes with some giftednesses as well as some differences. But the young years are very hard because you are odd. You are socially, there's a social impairment there that makes you socially awkward and sometimes wanting not to be bullied or not to be feeling how different you are. And only later are some of those more gifted areas that may be present in you, only later are those going to be unfolded. So those young years are tough. It's important that we understand that this is a difference born in a person and not an illness that comes on. And it's just fundamentally different.
Yeah. We go next to Mary in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi, Connie.
Hi.
Thank you for the show. And, Connie, I wish I could carry you around with me. That's a very comforting word.
There you go.
As I said to the screener, this is possibly naive, but what has happened? It seems I'm 59. I used to ride my bike, throw it down, never lock it, walk the woods all by myself. You know, there wasn't that fear, and I don't think that my parents had that fear, but I'm not sure. And every decade, it just seems to be getting worse. And I just wondered if you could offer some insight.
I sense what you're sensing, and I don't know if it's actually getting worse or if our imaginations are so malignantly full of threat that we live as if it were true. And thus we bring to life the very thing that we fear the most. In other words, in a neighborhood where you know your neighbors and you've knocked on the doors and there's been block parties and you know who folks are, there's some way in which that block feels safe for the children. I have a single block. I live on a corner and I'm looking out my window as we speak. There's a single block and then it's a dead end. And there's a lot of kids on this block. And there's a sense of safety because the kids' parents know each other and the kids' parents watch out for these little ones. Just on this one little block, they're pretty young. I have a sense that, again, knowing each other is the way to combat this lonely sense that it's dangerous out there. So you go out there and meet each other to combat the sense that out there is where danger is. It's also where community is.
Thank you, Mary, very much for your call. Chris in Oconomowoc, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to thank you for the show, and I enjoy listening to you, Kathleen. I wanted to connect to something that Connie mentioned much earlier about the presence issue.
Yeah.
I don't think there's been enough said about the fact that his father has not been in his life for a long time, and this boy killer, and he was a boy.
Yeah.
You look at the pictures of him, which I think the media run way too much anyway, but that's another issue. But he was very disconnected, and he was basically living with his mom, and sometimes that's kind of overwhelming, and I think that there needs to be a bigger discussion about how boys need fathers and they need men to make men. And I think that's been lost, and there's a lot of women not listening to men or their boys who need men. And also in 2000, I think it was 2010, it was mentioned that's the last time he saw his brother.
Right.
So there's a brother-to-brother connection that I think is lacking in a lot of people's lives. And I think that needs to be discussed, where families are not turning towards each other, they're turning away from each other. And it's been said that fathers need to turn their hearts toward their sons.
You know, in the 1970s, during the women's movement, I was a young woman. I had just come out of college in 1970, 71. And I, in that desire for there to be opportunity for women, I briefly flirted with the notion that we're really the same. Boys and girls are really the same. And then nature and childbirth got my attention. And I had a daughter and a son, and I was forever disabused of the notion that boys and girls are made the same way. I have to say that I agree with this caller in that there is something more different between men and women than between women and women anywhere in the world of any race and any culture and any poverty level. I think women can connect to women just fine wherever we are, and men need each other. And I think that women cannot be sufficient. And I never imagined that I'd be saying this if you were to ask me this 40 years ago. And it's just a fact that there's something in that energy, in that biology, that has a different challenge. And we have a lot of early teachers who are mostly women. So I bless the men who go into primary education for our boys, because to see boy energy and to see a man in that classroom, to make it okay to be a boy, has to be one of the greatest gifts. And
yes.
I just can't agree enough that there is a need for healthy men who can be brave and who can be energetic and who can be physical in a way that gives our boys that sense of, and then to be protectors, and then to be to stick up for the underdog. These are things that brave men can do, and our boys need to see that and be called on for it by their men.
And he mentioned his father, who obviously was not very connected to his youngest son's life, and the brother as well. I'm wondering, considering the fact that there is so much of that now in our society, Connie, and I think mm-hmm. that it has... It's a huge issue, I think, and we ignore some of that. I'm wondering if that role, you mentioned teachers, I'm wondering about, you know, who puts the goodness in you, back to that, if
yeah.
that role can be filled by people who are not family members.
Well, there's certainly a deficit that comes. There's a loneliness, because as a human being, if your own blood doesn't have time or interest in you, it's very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But I find... I'll give you an example of a client that I saw once who had a very tragic early life story. I mean, really, really, there was no way to explain how functional he was. And I said, who put the good in you? Who did this? Who was the person that you looked to for guidance? He opened his wallet and he showed me a picture of William Shatner as Captain Kirk of the Starship Enterprise. And he said, this might seem funny, but those episodes where he was the brave protector, he was the person who solved problems, he was the person who was smart, and it's amazing how little we can live on as long as there's something, somebody putting some good into us. So don't underestimate a neighbor or a teacher or a grandma or an auntie or a cousin that you hardly ever see. It might be the most important person in that child's life.
Amen. Connie, we're almost at the end of the hour, and I want to thank you so much. I knew you could do this hour. We were asking so much. Well, Connie, we want to talk about giving at Christmas, but we also want to talk about grief and tragedy and shootings and guns and all of that. And you did it. It was a tall order. And thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it was a blessing to me as well, because I felt less disconnected. It was a way of feeling one with the listeners. So thank you, everybody, for helping me bear the unbearable.
Right. I think that why these hours are important, public radio hours like
Indeed.
This, because a lot of people are needing it, as we do as well. Thanks, Connie. Connie Kilmark, our guest this hour of the program. Connie is founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark and Associates, and you hear her somewhat regularly on our Wisconsin Public Radio programs. Just a reminder, we will talk about this issue tomorrow at 9, different angles, one with survivor of the Virginia Tech massacre, who survived 4 gunshot wounds that day, and he has gone on to become the Assistant Director of Victims and Youth Advocacy and Federal Legislation for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Richard Florida on the Geography of Gun Violence in America, also with us tomorrow. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We have news coming up momentarily. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produce this program Monday through Thursday from 9 to 11. Thanks for your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow starting at 9 o'clock. And there are interesting, informative, compelling conversations ahead. So stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.